Welcome to another episode of the Faith Work Rest podcast. Our mission is to help people discern their vocations and reimagine their occupation for the good of their neighbor and the glory of God. We're part of the Surge Network. It's a network of local churches united to put Jesus on display in their community. You can learn more at surgenetwork.com. Welcome back to another episode of the Faith Work and Rest podcast. This is Lauren Kutzko. I'm here with Kimberly Deckel and Jim Mullins, and we have a really exciting interview for you today with Caitlin Beatty, who is the former managing editor of Christianity Today. And not only that, but she was the youngest managing editor and the first female managing editor of Christianity Today, and just has some extraordinary things to share with us, and I'm excited about our conversation. She's also the author of the book, A Woman's Place, and so I think you guys will really benefit from what she has to say, our interview with her. But as we get into that, just wanted to kind of roll with the conversation we were having before we started, and what struck you, Jim, as you got to spend some time with her last week?
Yeah, well, first of all, what dawned on me is that a male carrying around a book called A Woman's Place in a coffee shop it's super awkward because people are going to assume that it's like it's, the chauvinist book.
Right. It's the way A Woman's Place has always been said, right? Not like the...
Like I'm like reading it to try to convince my wife or something like
that. Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. So after I got a few...
Tonight's date night. I'm trying to get ready.
Yeah. So after I got a few funny looks, I realized I need to just read this one at my house.
Like,
so,
hey, everybody. Yeah. Promise it's not what it looks like.
Yeah. So it's interesting. I really admire Caitlin's leadership. I've admired it from a distance for a while. Mm-hmm. How she seems to move toward the issues that are most controversial in a way that doesn't exemplify either retreat or rage, but has boldness and gentleness to it. And I think the thing that stood out most to me was how much the Industrial Revolution has shaped the way that we think about work today. Even shift work, even 9-to-5, men and women's roles in the marketplace. And it seems like there were probably some really appropriate things that were happening in that time, as far as like creating that shift work and whatnot. But we live in a different time, and it just provoked the question within me, what do the right structures, practices, rhythms of work look like in our day, in our particular context? Mm-hmm. So that's what stood out to me. How about you, Kimberly?
Yeah. Well, so the first thing for me is I love hearing another woman speak through pretty deep theological issues. I think that it's something that obviously women are really capable of doing. But, you know, I think even some of the writing that Caitlin's done and with her book, a piece of that is that a lot of times, though, like that hasn't been seen maybe as our role to have that voice in issues related to theology and even some of those kind of larger issues that may be seen as more controversial. I agree. Like, I love the way that she isn't afraid to speak up on that and talks in this about that type of leadership and recognizing that some of the things you say, like if you're a strong leader, people may not like everything you have to say, but that as Christians, we truly are called to be outward facing. We're called to speak out against injustices, things like that. And so that was really significant to me. I think anytime I have the opportunity to hear a woman speak on issues like that, like I dive in fully. I told Jim and Lauren that I could talk about this interview for days, literally, because there's just so many pieces of it that really spoke to me. So yeah, that's kind of the baseline of it, is just hearing a strong female voice speak into these issues. It's really important.
Yeah, it's good.
Yeah, definitely.
How about you, Lauren?
Yeah, for me, it was the Industrial Revolution also, I think, but maybe specifically, I think I've been struck as we've been getting into this faith and work conversation about the recency of the Industrial Revolution. Because, you know, essentially the beginning of the 20th century kind of spawned so much of the water that we're currently swimming in, or the air that we're breathing in, as it relates to the faith and work conversation. But obviously, God's call to work, God's call to his people as workers, has been around since long before that, right? So I don't know if anybody here is willing to kind of put an age on the universe, but you know, let's say it's only 5,000 years, or let's say it's, you know, many, many, many more than that. If the Industrial Revolution starts in 1900 or the late 1800s, that's just a sliver. Like, we've been in post-Industrial Revolution for a sliver of the amount of time that man's been around.
Right.
Yet mankind has always been able to fully live out the vocational and occupational call that God has placed on that. And so then the other thing I noticed, just to get kind of practical, is so many of us now, when we go to work, think about work as inextricably linked with things like Social Security, 401ks, vacation time, the 40-hour work week, 9 to 5 hours, an employer who decides what those things are and who's responsible for setting those boundaries, having somewhat of a sense of, you know, kind of even deserving some of those things. And but those things have been around for a sliver, a blip on the radar of humanity. And so I love to kind of go back to the middle of the 19th century, just in my thought, you know, sort of thought exercises, and further back even more, just to say, well, what would it look like to be? Because I'm a dad, and that's an important part for me of thinking about work, is what does it look like to have a healthy relationship with my wife and my kids and my work? What does it look like to have healthy rhythms of rest? And sometimes it's I find that, like we talked about email recently, if I put it in this context, I have some major challenges to figure out. But if I just imagine going back a couple hundred years, a lot of those challenges actually are very different.
Yeah.
But if we're talking about an objective reality of what God's called us to, it'll work in any of those eras.
Yeah.
And so I kind of want – it's like I want my personal theology of work to line up with God's theology of work. Which is probably redundant, but so anyway, I think it's just the recency of that. Like, we're talking about very recent times since the Industrial Revolution.
Yeah, it's had such a significant impact in such a short amount of time.
Or maybe not, because if time's going to go on for another 5,000 years, it may just vanish. Yeah. Like this information age beginning that we're at right now, it may just, we may just find out that minimum wage and social securities and retirement plans and sick days all just go away, because the Industrial Revolution was the sliver that just sort of is a mist that goes away.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know.
Okay. So, Kimberly. So I guess in terms of what you said earlier, Jim, like, I don't know that there's a ton of pushback, but this is all stuff that I spend a lot of time thinking about. And I think just with the interview in general, I'm going a little bit not off topic, but off from what talked about. So I was telling Lauren earlier that for me as a Christian woman, and especially when I became a mom, it was this really funky place of like, where do I belong? Where do I fit in? All of my close female friends who had kids were stay-at-home moms, and I wasn't a stay-at-home mom. And some of, I mean, and I would say that that was by choice. I mean, feeling like I love working. I love having a vocation. I love being a mom too. And I think that it actually really is possible to have a balance in both of those things. I don't think that like our culture or society or the church make that easy. But just that real feeling of kind of like, where do I fit in? And Caitlin talks in the interview about the church not, you know, not talking a lot about like vocation and the importance of that and how that's a part of carrying out God's kingdom here on earth. But I think especially we don't hear a lot about what that looks like for women, because oftentimes the assumption, the bias in the church is that women should be at home with the kids. And then I can only imagine for women who aren't moms, then even more so, kind of like, what is your place? Where do we fit in? How do we belong? And so I spent quite a bit of time kind of like working through and processing that, and also getting to a place of recognizing that God loves working moms too, that the work I'm doing outside of the home is also important and significant, and that I can just as much be carrying out God's mission through that as my male counterparts. And so some of what Caitlin had to say, and just hearing that perspective and hearing her talk about like interviewing other women, one of whom was your wife, about this, is always just refreshing to that reminder, like that I'm not living in a silo. I'm not the only woman kind of experiencing this, but I've done a lot of just kind of thinking through, how do I support other women who find themselves in similar places that I found myself in, and that there is like a space for them in the kingdom and in God's church.
Yeah. And I think that's really important. And I think with the interview today, Caitlin in her book does a really good job of supporting women in their work and talking about ways that you can do that. And then also the article that you mentioned, that the report that they had, the Center for Public Justice released, that she is the co-author of, Time to Flourish. I think that can be very helpful as well. So we're going to listen in to an interview with Caitlin Beatty as we ask her questions about her work, her book, and this important report about what it means for families to have time together to flourish in a world where family and work seem like they're in conflict. So let's listen in.
Well, I'm here with Caitlin Beatty, and someone whom I have heard about for a long time. I see her name connected to many of the things that I admire and appreciate in the world, things that were happening with Christianity Today, things that are happening with the Center for Public Justice. Basically, important questions that are being asked and reflected on with depth. Wherever that's happening, I tend to see Caitlin's name around. But Caitlin, can we just start with you telling us a little bit about yourself? What's the mini bio for you?
Yeah, well, thanks so much for having me on. So I am a Midwestern native. I grew up in Dayton, Ohio, and became a Christian when I was 13 at a youth revival concert where there was an altar call at the end. And there's a lot to be said about altar calls, but it was very transformative for me. When it came time to go to college, I really wanted to go to a Christian college. So I ended up at Calvin, which is in Grand Rapids, a good Christian Reformed, traditionally or historically Dutch Reformed college, and really had the intellectual aspects of faith provided for me there. Was involved in the student newspaper. And I think it was through writing and editing on the student newspaper that I really realized that I enjoyed publishing. I enjoyed the idea of writing and editing articles that would speak into a community and help a community grapple with important conversations and questions. And so I had a brief stint in Oxford through a study abroad program. I did theological studies there. And then when I came back, pretty much right away, started working at Christianity Today magazine. It's based in the Chicago suburbs, founded by the evangelist Billy Graham in the 50s, mm-hmm. a leading publication for evangelical thought leaders. And little did I know I would end up there for 10 years. While I was there, I helped to found a website called Hermeneutics, which was a women's website. Was involved in a project on Christians and urban engagement called This Is Our City. And then the last 4 years that I was at CT, I was the print managing editor. And around that time, around the time that I was managing editor, I also decided to write a book, which came out in 2016 called A Woman's Place, A Christian Vision for Your Calling in the Office, the Home, and the World, really helping women have a strong theological foundation for thinking about the goodness of professional work and helping women wade through some of the questions and tensions that can come up for women when they think about professional work. Yeah, so I left CT in 2016. I have done lots of freelance work since then. We have worked with the Center for Public Justice on a report on family leave policies that we'll talk about soon. But yeah, it's been a really interesting roller coaster. But I just have this sense of God's provision and providence in taking me to Christianity Today, and I'm just so grateful for the opportunities that I had there and the skills that I learned there. I learned a lot. So yeah, I think that's the short bio version. There's a longer version, of course.
That's great. That's great. And I think your work, many people have been impacted by it, and it's ricocheting around the valley here in Phoenix as well. But oftentimes, I don't know if people, they connect your name to some of the work that's influencing them and is happening. Like, for instance, the hermeneutics thing. I've heard many people reference that.
Yeah.
This Is Our City, so on and so forth. So I wanted to ask a few get-to-know-you questions, one sentence, rapid fire, just to people to get a picture of who you are. So, and what's influenced you. So most influential book outside of the Bible, what would that be?
That's so hard. I would have to come back to the Lord of the Rings trilogy. I know that's three books, but yeah, Lord of the Rings fan over here.
So here's the thing with Lord of the Rings. I feel about Lord of the Rings like I feel about jazz. Like I so desperately want to like it, but I don't. And so I love the idea of it.
Yes.
But it,
I feel that way about Harry Potter, actually.
Like, okay, there you go.
Questions. Like, so many people point to Harry Potter as the thing that gives them the most joy, and I'm like, nope, never got into it. I could never get on board.
Yeah, absolutely. So. Absolutely. I want to so bad, though.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
So most influential relationship outside of someone that you're related to?
That would be my friend, Sarah. We met while working at Christianity Today, and she lives in Alabama with her family. I'm the godmother to her second child, 2 out of 4. So, nice. Yeah, just friends who have really been, you know, faithful and sustained me over the last 10 years.
Excellent. Well, what's one physical location, a place that has formed you and shaped you?
I'm going to go with Monterey, California, because before my parents kind of settled in Ohio, we moved around a lot when I was little because my dad was in the military, and one of the places that he was stationed was Monterey, which is just one of the most, I think, objectively beautiful places in the world. And that was the first place that really exposed me to the beauty of creation. I mean, even though I didn't have the language for it then, just spending time on the beach and at the Monterey Bay Aquarium. And there was kind of this wonder over creation that was sparked in me then at a very young age.
Excellent. Excellent. So did the Kuiperian stuff come before the beach, or did the beach come before the Kuiperian stuff?
The beach came way before the Kuiperian stuff. Like, I was 5, you know,
okay.
Parents, I mean, when I was really little, like when I was that age, my parents were not believers. I mean, just in the most nominal sense. So like, I had no theological or scriptural, you know, framework for understanding it. But I just see that as God, you know, awakening that love of creation in me before I even had language for it.
That's wonderful. So tell us a little bit about your sense of calling. So you've named several of the projects and institutions that you've been a part of, but what's the common thread of the good works that you sense that God has made you to do?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, as for a lot of people, my sense of calling is beyond a particular job title or role. Mm-hmm. But if I were to find a common thread through all the good work that I have done, you know, since starting out after college, I would say communicating ideas, communicating about issues through the written and spoken word in a way that inspires, provides clarity, and challenges. So, writing is the thing that I feel like I can't not do. Speaking I can do, it doesn't hit the same kind of, you know, passion point for me, but the common thread is communication, you know, communicating thoughts and ideas and doing so in a way that inspires other people, that provides clarity on complex issues and that challenges, you know, ultimately challenges the church to be, you know, to be fully on mission for the kingdom of God in our particular moment, in our particular cultural context.
Yeah, yeah. How did you discover that about yourself?
Well, I mentioned, you know, working on the student newspaper, and I would write something about an issue going on campus, and I would have people come back to me and say, thank you so much for writing about that. I hadn't really thought about it that way before, but you really helped me understand this complicated issue. And then I had a very similar experience while on staff at Christianity Today, where I would write editorials. So in every issue of the print magazine, we have an editorial page where, you know, the editors are speaking into timely, complex, sometimes controversial issues, and kind of taking our stand. The name of the editorial page used to be Where We Stand. So it was kind of like a flag planted. Here's what we believe. Here's what we think the church needs to do moving forward. And so I wrote several editorials during my time at CT, and just, I think what that awakened in me was the sense of leadership, really. I mean, the sense that I'm, you know, there are writers, there are journalists where their primary drive is to simply inform, you know, here is what happened in the world. But my sense of calling goes beyond just here's what you need to know to here's how you should move forward. So there's an element of leading there, even though it's very indirect, you know, but that sense of leadership, I think, was definitely shaped in me at Christianity Today. And then we've had a very similar experience with A Woman's Place, you know, wanting to shape how the church and maybe especially Christian women think about their work and helping them think about it and approach it in a more theologically informed way that I hoped would be helpful, inspiring, and challenging in the best way.
Yeah, yeah. Well, one of the things I've noticed, and I think you've alluded to it there, is that in your work, you've tended to move towards issues that are very tense. One of those being the political discourse that's happening in the U.S. and issues of justice connected to it. Mm-hmm. And I've noticed that in this season, there really is a tendency to either respond with retreat or rage, but a real hesitancy to step into that intense, controversial space and to speak with nuance, wisdom, listening, and yet boldness at the same time. It really stood out to me when you guys wrote the editorial about critiquing Trump and stepping into some of those controversial things. So I want to ask, how have you in this season and other seasons, what have you learned about leadership in the midst of controversy?
Yes. Well, I have learned that it is not for the faint of heart.
Sure.
I think one thing that I have learned both as an editor at Christianity Today and then beyond CT as a freelance writer is that criticism and disagreement is just part of the leadership game. You know, like if you are someone who wants to please everybody, or in some sense, maybe, you know, is called to be more of a peacemaker or to really be focused on relational unity, that is a very good and needed type of leadership. But I think most leaders at some point have to adjust to the idea that not everybody is going to like them or agree with them. And especially if you are leading in a place like the internet, which, you know, the internet and especially social media have just become really contentious, sometimes very ugly places for discourse. And so, I mean, I personally have a support group. I mean, not very unofficial, you know, I don't pay these people to support me, but basically a group of friends who are also writing for the public where it's just a safe space. It's a place of encouragement. It's a place to kind of process what's going on. I think that's absolutely essential if you are leading on divisive topics to know that you will probably take some personal hits for it. And so you need people kind of in your corner in that process. But yeah, the internet can be a really ugly place. I think we're in a very divided, contentious place in our kind of national moment. And so I think, you know, the retreat for me has never been an option because I think that Christians are called to engage the issues of the day. I think that Christians are called to have an outward facing posture toward their neighbors, toward their communities, towards the broader civil society. But I also, you know, the retreat and rage model that you mentioned earlier, rage can be a really powerful temptation, and it's not good. You know, I think there is such a thing as righteous anger.
Yeah, but, right.
You know, going on Twitter and putting someone on blast or kind of raging about something in 280 characters, it like satisfies an itch, but it doesn't really get us towards something constructive. And it doesn't usually advance the conversation. So I think somewhere between retreat and rage is something like prophetic engagement, you know, and truth telling. You know, Christians are to be known in the public square as truth tellers. And sometimes that means saying and speaking truths that are hard for people to hear and that will incite backlash. And I think that's just part of the game, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know if I answered your question, but
just no, absolutely.
Bring it full circle. It is not for the faint of heart, and you definitely need a good support system and like ways to disengage. You know, I think that's why technological fasts and Sabbaths are also really important. That there is a space where you're not having to face the vitriol in such a direct way, and you're able to kind of reconnect to the flesh and blood people in your life, to the flesh and blood church community you're a part of, and just reorient toward that.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So a technological fast, what does that look like for you?
Oh, I wasn't saying I do it. I just think it's, I have, you know, certain rules on the weekends. I really try not to use Twitter or Facebook over the weekends. If it's a Sunday afternoon, I'm trying to shut down my computer and my email and my phone and, you know, read a book or be with friends or go outside. But it's hard. And of course, you know, people like Andy Crouch have written a lot about the importance of setting proper parameters around technology in our lives. And if we're not careful, they encroach upon just the ways that we as embodied beings find connection with the people around us. And I think that's what we all crave. And we so often turn to technology to get this kind of sense of connection, but with very little commitment involved or time involved. I think, you know, technology can obviously be a wonderful tool. We wouldn't be able to have this podcast recording without it. And yet, it's something that is very powerful. And the more powerful a tool is, the greater the parameters need to be around it.
Well, it seems like one of the other things that you've really engaged is the question of women in the workplace in the 21st century as Christians and helping them navigate some of the weighty questions. You wrote a book called A Woman's Place. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us the core message of that book?
So the core message is work is a God-given gift and call for all humans. We see that in the earliest pages of scripture. Women are humans, and therefore work is a gift for women. I think in conversations with women over the past several years, a common refrain I heard in those conversations is that women experience a lot of tension and churning and questioning around professional work. And some of that comes from very specific teachings on gender roles in the church. Some of that comes from just the reality of if you are a professional woman and you have children, especially young children at home, there's often this divide or this tension around your time and your responsibilities and can you do it all? And then I think in a lot of churches, as you probably have encountered or know, there just isn't that much teaching on professional work in general. You know, I think churches have made extraordinary strides forward as the faith and work movement has really taken shape over the last, you know, 30, 40 years, but there still can be a gap, like a vocational and a discipleship gap in a lot of local churches around professional work for both men and women. Think especially for women, if most of the teaching specifically for women is oriented around home responsibilities, women who are spending a lot of their time during the week outside the home in some kind of professional capacity can feel marginalized, or like, I don't know how to talk about work at church, and what does my work have to do with my identity as a Christian and as a woman? So I wanted to really wade into those tensions and really encourage other women to find the goodness and satisfaction in their work. And a lot of that has, you know, been personal for me. I'm unmarried. I don't have children. I've spent the majority of my adult life deeply invested in work and finding a lot of joy and satisfaction in it. And yet I haven't always known, even for myself, how to talk about that in church communities. And so I think a lot of us end up writing the books that we wish we had had 10 years ago, you know? And so I wanted to write as much for myself, and knowing that surely there would be so many other women in a similar space.
Yeah. So what would you say? All right, I'm going to give you a hypothetical situation. And imagine that for some strange, inexplicable reason, it became a law that books could only be one chapter long. You could only have one chapter. And so for your book, you had to choose the one chapter that would be retained. Which one would you want to be preserved and get out to most people?
That's a great question. And honestly, most books written should probably be about a chapter long anyway, and should become articles or essays instead of whole books. But I would say, so chapter 6, the title is How She Does It All. And this is where I really get into the primary tensions that women face around. I think, you know, if I had to distill it down, it is the tension between the call and responsibility to care for young children and the call and responsibility to invest in professional work. And I think at the end of the day, that is where a lot of women feel the most tension. And so I wanted to get into, you know, why we have those tensions in the first place. There are cultural and economic and historical reasons we feel that tension. There are obviously biological reasons we feel that tension. There are also kind of cultural norms that I think increase that tension. And so that's where I get into things like family leave or family supportive policies in the workplace, you know, the roles of fathers and extended family and a community to help raise children. I really wanted to make sure to root my ideas in the lives of actual women. And so I ended up, through the course of about a year, meeting with about 10 small groups of women. There were 120 women who participated in those groups. And that allowed me to include their stories in the book, to include anecdotes and to quote them, and to just really root my ideas in real women's lives. And the theme of tension around professional work and family was by far the most prominent theme in all of the small groups. So I think I would retain this chapter just because I think that's where the rubber really meets the road for a lot of women.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I guess this brings us to a recent report that you co-authored, the Time to Flourish report, about the tensions between work and family. It seems like there are a lot of related and overlapping themes here. Mm-hmm. Can you just tell us a little bit about this report and what compelled you to write it?
Yeah, well, I think you're right that in some ways working on this report for the Center for Public Justice was a very natural extension of the writing and thinking I had already done about women in the workforce. I would say, though, that the tensions that are felt between kind of work time and family time, work responsibility, family responsibility, are not women's problem alone. I mean, I think most modern American adults who have children or who have extended family to take care of feel a great burden of responsibility and feel that their margins in time and energy to care for their family, to care for their children, to be present to their children is greatly strained. And so that is really the problem that we wanted to address in this report, just acknowledging that there's, for most adults, work and family are experienced as these competing spheres of responsibility. And we think that there are things that both, you know, Christian workplace leaders, people who have influence over how workplaces are conducted, but also policymakers looking at the role of government in, you know, whether that's local, state, or federal, are there policies that can be put in place that protect workers' time to be with their family? So yeah, just acknowledging that, you know, as a Christian institution, the Center for Public Justice believes that family is really the most foundational institution in human life. And when we see the corrosion of the family, all these other institutions in society suffer. So we want to find ways to protect the family, the institution of the family, and family's time together so that the whole of society is better able to flourish.
One of the things that I think was most that stood out to me in the report was the connection between the Industrial Revolution and how we perceive of family roles and of the flow and the life of the family. Can you talk about how, I mean, this was mentioned both in your book and in the report, but talk to us about how the Industrial Revolution has shaped the way that we view work and family.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to condense down to a couple minutes. And of course, there are books and books written about the effects of the Industrial Revolution. But in essence, before the modern Industrial Revolution, work and family were essentially complementary spheres because the locus of economic activity was either the farm, you know, the homestead where a family lived together and worked alongside each other, or it would be like a small workshop or something, literally, you know, a building or a locus of work that was in proximity to the home. So home life and family life all worked together to provide for families. You know, most of this was subsistence farming or very modest wages to kind of make ends meet for the family. The Industrial Revolution shifted the locus of economic activity away from the home and to the factory, to the office, away from the place where the family spent time together. So with the Industrial Revolution, you had a family member, you know, leaving the home maybe early in the day or late in the day if it was a late shift, and working away from the home and then providing, getting a wage and bringing the wage back to the family. And, you know, that is more or less the work home dynamic that we still live with, even though a lot of us do work from home thanks to technology. You know, most of us think of work as something that takes place away from the household. And the Industrial Revolution also changed the way that we think about time. The notion of shift work, the idea that workers could be scheduled to work really around the clock, because the efficiency and the production aspects of capitalism were the driving forces of how we thought about work. So instead of work being something that you would do from sun up to sun down, it could take place at all manner of day. And I think we continue to live with that. Of course, you know, there are people who work the third shift, who work overnight, but even for kind of white collar workers, middle class workers, I think we still feel the pull toward working around the clock. You know, it's very hard for me not to check my emails in the evenings so that I could, so that I can be productive throughout the day. Technology, you know, allows us to be thinking about work even when we're not at the workplace. And that all contributes to an encroachment over time on, you know, time that is protected for the family to be together. We think that presence is really important, being able to be present to family, especially in crucial moments like after the birth of a child, or you have a family member who's struggling with medical or health issues, and you need to be present with them in their time of suffering. And we want workplaces to be living out the kind of cultures that say there are more important things in life than productivity and efficiency. And there should be time set apart simply for the family. And we're not just going to say that, but we're going to create policies and, you know, rules for workplace conduct that clearly honor the importance of family time.
Well, it's interesting, as I was reading the report and you described the pressures and the stresses that families feel, I found myself really resonating. And I think it's very common. Here's how much I resonated with it. As I was going through it, I was actually surprised to find that my wife was one of the people who was interviewed. So there was a reason why I was resonating with it.
Yeah.
I was like, this hits home, like literally.
Wait,
yeah.
I'm sorry. What is your wife's name?
Jenny Mullins.
Okay.
So when it talked about the special needs and some of the considerations with that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And when it got to that part, I was like, oh, I wonder what it's going to say about special needs, because I really feel that. And then my wife was quoted. So that was a fun surprise. But I would say that when, as a pastor, whenever I talk to people, one of the struggles that they have is with this question of time to be with my family in these crucial moments, time to get all the work that I need done. And I even like to joke about the fragmented nature of society, of even when you go into a gym to work out, everything's so fragmented that you look out into a gym and you see a bunch of activities that mimic what work once was for the rest of the world.
Right.
Like, you have nowhere to climb or nothing to lift, so you have to pretend like you're doing these things. You have no boat, so you've got to get on the row machine.
Yeah.
And so it just seems like there's this, what used to be integrated,
right,
exercise,
right,
and family and work and productivity were integrated parts of life, have become so fragmented.
This
My
is
question
why
is
I don't go to the gym. Yeah. I mean, I just can't go to a gym if it's that fragmented.
Oh, sure.
That's my excuse for not working out.
Well, you know, I'll take on that excuse too. But you do have to. There is something real between your driving, and you have to make a decision Will I go do work? Will I go spend time with community and friends and family, or will I go exercise? These are not integrated like they were for most of history.
Right.
So a question on that is, you really focused in on time and addressing the time issue instead of wage, place, a whole number of things like that. Why center in on time?
I mean, I think, you know, obviously a lot of families feel a financial pinch in when they're trying to balance work and family. They're just feeling the pressure of providing for children, providing for extended family, and simply making enough money in order to provide for everyone's needs. But I think for a lot of us, the core tension is not around money and how will we make ends meet. It's really around time, which is a kind of commodity, you know, and it's a kind of commodity that we invest in certain things over others. And it's, once it's gone, it's gone. You know, and so I think a lot of families feel that time is their most precious commodity, and it's also the most difficult to secure because of all the other things that impinge upon our time, that ask for our time. And so even having workplace policies in place that honor and respect time as a commodity, and just purely from a business sense, when you think about, you know, a family where the mother has just had a child and those first several weeks that are so precious, you have that sense that we don't get this time back. We don't get the time back to be present with an infant. And so for workplaces to even just provide some kind of leave policy, even if it's unpaid, I think most women would, you know, even if it's not paid, they're just grateful for that time to have away from work. They don't have to worry about work if it's 2 months, 3 months, 6 months, a year. That is one policy that can just honor the crucial time that parents and young children have right after birth. And I think it's, you know, when we think about the most precious, important moments of our lives, we are thinking about time spent with other people. We're thinking about investing in time with the people that we love. We're usually not thinking about like a lavish vacation and how much money we spend. And we're probably trying not to think about how much money we spent. We're thinking about the value of time and the way that time, in some sense, you can't put a value on it because it's, it is so precious and it is where we are known and loved and where we live into God's invitation for us to be in bonds of family. You know, everybody has a family. Everybody is born into a family. And obviously there could be a lot of brokenness and pain there. But family is so crucial. It's what we come into the world with. And so as Christians, we affirm that. You know, we have a theology of family that honors and affirms its uniqueness. And the report is really about putting that into some sort of policy or practices for the broader society.
Yeah. So I want to walk through some of those spheres and just hear what your recommendations would be, or your questions or considerations. So for instance, I want to start with the individual and move all the way up to public policy and what the recommendations you guys have for each of those. So what can individuals do to address this?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, all of us have some freedom in how we use our time. And so we either come up with, you know, personal rules, we come up with kind of a family motto that says, we're going to spend our time together in a particular way. I know families where when they, you know, having dinner together every night is a big priority. And when you sit down for dinner, the cell phones go away. You know, that is one really straightforward way to honor family time together without the encroachment of other responsibilities. If you are an individual leader at a workplace, you have some kind of agency over how that workplace honors the family commitments of its employees. So are there conversations that you can have as a workplace leader to begin to shift the needle a little bit, whether it's we're instituting a new policy about emails in the evenings, we're agreeing that we want to give our employees flexible time to essentially make their own schedules. I know a lot of parents of young children really value flex time because their employers essentially trust them to get the work done in a schedule that works well for them. So if a parent has to run out and pick their child up from, you know, kindergarten in the middle of the day or a doctor's appointment or, you know, that's okay. You don't have to get your work done 9 to 5. There can be some flexibility in when you get your work done. Yeah, I think that covers the individual.
Yeah, certainly.
So what was the next level?
I think you address both individual and family.
Mm-hmm.
And then also, what would you say about organizational leaders, people who have some agency and some authority to make changes within their organization?
Yeah, I mean, I think, I kind of already talked about this with the individuals, but if you are an institutional leader, you know, sometimes it's really sitting down with other leaders in the workplace, with, you know, the HR department, and becoming proactive about putting some of the policies in place. So making informal or unofficial rules official. At Christianity Today, over the course of several years, there had been several female employees who wanted to take certain types of leave after giving birth, and they were able to kind of work out what that might look like on a case-by-case basis. But over the past several years, there have been so many young women who, you know, want to keep working after the birth of a child, but also want some time off. And I think when there's the groundswell and the need is such, or the demand is such, that's when informal or unofficial policies become official. And I think CT has a much more clear, proactive, generous policy regarding, you know, leave after the birth of a child than they did 10 or 20 years ago. And that's really just based on the demand for that kind of policy.
Yeah.
So,
and then that's great. And what about public policy recommendations?
Yeah, well, it's tricky. So, you know, at the Center for Public Justice, we recognize that we are not government officials and that there are different approaches to working out what public policy would look like. You know, there are people who would greatly favor kind of wide-reaching federal mandated public policies around, you know, paid family leave. I would say, just on that note, the United States is in a minority in terms of other developed nations in terms of having kind of federal paid family leave policies in place. There are other people who really feel like, you know, that kind of federal policy and mandated federal policy infringes upon the rights of small businesses, of religious nonprofits, to come up with leave policies that work best for them given their financial limitations. And, you know, at CPJ, we honor the freedom of small religious nonprofits to come up with leave policies that make sense for them. We don't want to push for policies that would overburden those nonprofits with financial obligations. But basically, we affirm that workers should not be penalized for their family responsibilities. We think that all workplaces, from kind of high powered, you know, CEO level to the person who is driving Uber or who's working the third shift at McDonald's, family is significant and crucial for everybody, regardless of income level. And we think workplaces should honor family commitments, regardless of, you know, the type of work being done or the income level, you know, being achieved. So, I realize, you know, we kind of intentionally didn't want to wade too much into public policy recommendations because that is not our expertise, but instead we came up with some principles for family supportive policies. So here are the foundational commitments that would then lead policymakers, workplace leaders, to create policies that make sense for them.
That's good. That's good. And I guess my final question would be, if you could choose a room full of people who are going to sit down and read this report, and you get to choose who's around the table, let's just say that there's, you know, four or five seats around the table. They're going to sit down, read the report, and have a good discussion about it. Who would you invite to that table? Anyone in the world or anyone in history? Feel free.
Oh,
just
gosh.
Anyone that comes
wow.
to mind.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. It could be anyone.
Well, thinking really pragmatically, I guess I would invite Marco Rubio because he's been trying to advance family supportive workplace policies and paid family leave policies for a long time. And I think you know, at CPJ, we would love for him to understand how faith communities approach some of these questions and the kind of the commitments that lead us to value family enough to have policies in place that protect family.
Okay, so we've got Marco Rubio. We've given him plenty of water. And then who else is going to come around the table?
Oh, gosh. That's a really good question. Well, who's the most like influential pastor in the United States?
I have no idea. Well, I did just see a video about a mock video about a fantasy pastor draft or something like that.
Whoever the most influential.
Let's say Tim Keller.
Yeah, Tim Keller, Rick Warren, one of those guys can come.
Yeah.
Because I think, to be honest, we, in the writing of the report, we tried to interview several pastors just to see, well, how are these issues affecting, you know, members of your church, people in your community? And we had a really hard time engaging pastors. I don't know if it's just there are so many things that pastors have to be thinking about, and this just feels like another issue to be thinking about. But whoever the most influential pastor is in the country, if that person could sit down and read the report and then tell all the other pastors to read it too, that would be great. gosh. I feel like the right answer is Jesus.
Yeah, he'd be present.
Yeah. I think that's all that's coming to mind. So Marco Rubio, the most influential pastor in the country, and Jesus.
That's awesome. I think that'd be a great table. Let me populate a few seats too.
Yeah.
I would put Wendell Berry at the table.
Oh yeah, that's a great idea.
Just to get his sage wisdom and contributing to that conversation. And I would probably, and this is totally biased, I'd probably put my daughter at the table. Mm-hmm. She is a 9-year-old girl on the autism spectrum. She has her struggles. She has areas of just really unique insight and brilliance. And I think those folks would read this report with a little more weight in her presence, I think. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So
that's really
anyway,
good.
I appreciate you putting the report together, writing the book, leading amidst controversy, and I look forward to hearing what's coming next with Brazos Press and the good work you're doing there. Thanks for taking the time.
Thanks so much for having me, Jim.
Yeah, it was really our pleasure, and we hope we can connect again soon. Thanks.
That sounds great. Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed today's podcast. Before we sign off, we wanted to let you know that we would really appreciate any feedback you have for us. In particular, it would really help us out if you left a comment and gave a rating on iTunes. It will help us get the word out. A 5-star rating would be awesome, but we appreciate honesty. Also, if you are seeking some clarity about your work and calling, we would love to connect with you and help provide some career coaching. You can find out more about the career coaching at faithworkrest.com. Until next time, we pray that God would help you discern your vocation, reimagine every aspect of your occupation, and give you rich, life-giving rhythms of rest. We pray that your work would glorify God and seek the good of your neighbor. See you next week.